says, forget about the Yerushalmi that Rashi is citing. We rely on the Talmud Bavli. Shemutar lahakdim sha'ava revi'a bein l'kriyas from Rabbeinu l'tzvila ad kam lashon Rabbeinu Yaakov. So Rabbeinu Tam is making this very strong point, which is that we follow our local custom, and the Meiri then, V'achal pi she'ein onu nismachim, even though we don't entirely agree with Rabbeinu Tam, the Meiri says, mikom akom le'tzei yidei chavad kriyas shema b'tchuma shel chamami, mikom akom onu nismachim, I rely at least at the sunset, perhaps not until say Tavkochol. So the Meiri wants to make some kind of a compromise here. And let's also read what so this is the position of Rabbi Elazar ben Natan, who was about 10 years older, Rabbeinu Tam and Rabbeinu Tam, and then a couple of generations later from Rabbi Eliezer ben Yoel Halevi, we have also a discussion of this point, and then we will read what Professor Katz has to say.
This holds true for Shabbos also?
Yeah. When do we read the Kriyat Shema at night? Misha'a she'akohanim nechnasim le'echol b'tumatan ad sof ha'yom mishvar kol ad v'agal she'ma r'shach gam rav Yehuda mishmar l'achar krav netzatra filo avanam lo ela. Okay. Alright, now he says v'nahagu mi'emot rabotein lo harishonim, but our custom from our very early
in Germany
he was living in Cologne, I think, v'nahagu mi'emot rabotein harishonim shemitpalalim ba'artzeinu mincha u'ma'ariv b'yachad. We daven mincha and ma'ariv together. V'korin kriyat shema mi ba'od yom. V'lo kidivrei hatana'im ha'el. We don't follow what it says in this Mishnah. U'pliyahi me'ein haraglayim v'ayasod. And it's astonishing. What is the basis for this? D'lachorah ma'inan v'kriyat shema b'rechatet k'mayr v'lo kriyat shema shal mitatoshu v'lagenu min ha'zikin. Not what we say before we go to sleep, etc., etc. וראיתי שכתבו ראשונים בזה דברים שלא ישרון בעיניי. I've seen our earlier comments, meaning I suppose Rashi and others, which don't make sense to me. ונראה לי עיקר הטעם כאשר מקובלני בשם רבנו תם, ולט הלכתה ככל הניתנוי, that all of these statements in the Mishnah are not the correct הלכה, אלא כדתנן בחרת תפילת השחר, תפילת המנחה עד הערב, Rabbi Yehuda omer atvagan mincha shu yed al shal chaser revid ayinu sha'or revid kodem halayla sheitzei the kochavim upaskin and hatam David Rabbi Yehuda avid midrav tzali shel Shabbat ve'al Shabbat. Okay, so we see that, and I'll let you read the rest of this because I want to now concentrate on Professor Katz's analysis of this.
What do we see from this? That the minhag.
That for the Ravya and for Rabbeinu Tam and for the Ravan, you had a dispute between the Minhag and the written text and the Mishnah. And according to Rabbeinu Tam, he's willing to perform some mental gymnastics to simply say that the Mishnah is a minority view in order to sustain the local custom. So let's read what Professor Katz has to say about this. While Rabbi Eliezer ben Natan, the Rabban, already referred to a protest against this custom, I'm reading on page 96, he considered an ancient custom whose reason was clear. We've just read that. Rabbeinu Tam, a contemporary of Rabban, attacked those who questioned the validity of the custom, using arguments of his own. Even Rabbi Eliezer ben Yoel Halevi, a Rabbi, a generation or two later, declared it has been a custom from the time of our earliest rabbis that in our land we say the Mincha and Maariv prayers together, and that we recite the Shema in daylight. However, he already expresses the reservations about the custom, saying its basis and reason is a mystery. A clear distinction between the two halachic approaches to the custom can be discerned. I'm reading from the bottom paragraph of this page. The Ashkenazic scholars mentioned above understood their role to be a halachic justification of the custom, not its abolition. Nor did they attempt to circumvent the custom privately for their own religious stringency, as did Rabbeinu Haigon's questioners. The difference between the two communities, one which, according to the Gaon's testimony, decided for their own convenience to say the Ma'ariv prayer in daylight, and the other, whose scholars declared the custom to be time-honored, lies not in the practical realm, but in the attitude of the religious leadership to custom. In the latter community, that is in Ashkenaz, unlike the former, there is a complete identification with the custom. The religious and social significance of this difference will be examined below. Before doing so, however, we must consider those Ashkenazic scholars who are called upon to re-examine a custom in the generations following Rashi. The most detailed and unreserved defense of the Ashkenazic custom is that of Rabban. There is no indication of any attempt to change the accepted custom in his region, that is, the cities of the Rhineland. It is likely that news of such an attempt reached him from France, where doubts were raised as to the validity of the custom, as we shall see immediately. Rabban set out not only to preserve the accepted custom, but also to validate its religious status. For this reason, he rejected the compromise, of which he knew, surprisingly enough, not from Rashi, but from Reino Hanano's work, whereby the recitation of the Shema at bedtime fulfills the commandment. This compromise was unacceptable, for it was clear to him that the synagogue ritual, including the Shema and its blessings, and the Shemoneh Esrei, were all of one piece, possessing equal religious status, and that the Rishonim, i.e. the great scholars of the city of the Rhineland in earlier generations, had fixed its time during the day. This ruling seems to contradict the Mishnah, which determined the time of recitation of the Shema, in accordance with the great biblical verse, when Elias Dan raises up at night, the time for sleep, and the statements of the Tanaim, who considered other times to be appropriate. In all cases, this was close to nightfall. Rabban responded that the Talmudic authorities had referred to two different times, for an anonymous Braita states, the sages protested the words to a man on returning home from the field in the evening should not say, I shall go home and eat a little and drink a little and sleep a little, and then I should recite the Shema. This meant that anyone who wished to eat his evening meal was obliged to pray first and then eat. The time of sleep or nightfall, according to other Tanaim, were designated for those who had not eaten earlier or would not eat at all. In the Rhineland, they used to eat during the day in the summer. We know that this was indeed the medieval custom. The evening meal was eaten 2 or 3 hours before the sunset. They could not eat before reciting the Shema, and since they instituted this in summer, they also instituted it in winter. Another set reason for saying the evening prayer during the daylight is deduced from the Agadic literature, which draws a parallel between the prayers and the sacrifices. It emerges from all the above that Rabban was a loyal adherent of the local custom, which he considered sanctified because of its connection with the ancient scholars. He was interested not only in preserving the custom, but also in reviving its religious status. He therefore took pains to remove any doubt as to the custom's validity as practiced in Ashkenaz, regarding not only the time of the evening service, but the Shema as well. Had the view been accepted, the recitation of the Shema at bedtime fulfills the commandment, reading the Shema in the synagogue would have been reduced to a preparatory act and not the fulfillment of the commandment. Rabban insisted that the communal prayer for which the inhabitants of the Rhineland cities gathered each evening and morning had to be considered complete fulfillment of the commandment, untainted by flaw or doubt. Rabbeinu Yaakov Tam, born in the year 1100, was 10 years younger than the Rabban. Their relationship is attested by personal correspondence and is discernible in their treatment of the same issue, each in his own way. Rabbeinu Tam was also faced by the issue of when the Shema should be recited, and his treatment of it was much more pointed than that of Rabban, for he became aware of an attempt to change the accepted practice in the community whose spiritual leader he was. Rabbeinu Tam's remarks on this issue were transmitted in various versions, etc., etc. A more detailed response of Rabbeinu Tam was permitted among his disciples, and then we read, in fact, the... And he quotes from the Iri, which we just read. A scrutiny of the text reveals that the tradition between the custom and the halacha stated in the Mishnah concerning the nighttime reading of the Shema led to a reaction in practice. In order to avoid contradiction, some of Rabbeinu Tam's contemporaries changed the accepted custom, ate the evening meal before the Maariv prayer, and prayed at nightfall, or prayed at nightfall and ate afterwards. Apparently, the first alteration was instituted during the week, and the second on the Sabbath, and Rabbeinu Tam rejects both in no uncertain terms. The first alteration violates the word of the sages who warned against eating and sleeping a little, etc. This is also the basis for Rabban's argument. It is clear from the Rabban and Rabbeinu Tam's statements that their generation did not view merely as a habit the Ashkenazic practice of eating the evening meal while it was still daylight. And I think there's a mistake here. The davening mincha maariv service before them, but invested it with some quasi-halachic status, so any deviation was seen as a blow against the religious tradition. During the week, the deviation contradicted the statement mentioned above, while on the Sabbath, they did not act correctly, for the behaviors were still in the realm of the secular after having sanctified the Sabbath, meaning that having ushered in the Sabbath during the daylight by lighting candles and accepting upon the tradition against working, once again they usher in the Sabbath and the Maariv prayer after nightfall. These are specific arguments of a halachic or perhaps an emotional religious nature. However, Rabbeinu Tam also makes a general claim against the custom of the fathers, or in another version, the custom of our fathers, which count as Torah where the halacha is indistinct. That is, wherever the written halacha does not provide a clear guideline, one must rely on the custom and grant it legal status.
That's about the most important part, I would say.
That's right, that is the most important part.
Because otherwise, why study the here and there? Just go do a survey of all the minhagim throughout the world.
But in order to fully appreciate Rabbeinu Tam's stand, it is incumbent upon us to take note of a facet of the history of medieval culture. In Europe, and particularly in Northern Europe, where there are many cloudy days, time was not generally measured. This is in contrast to the ancient biblical, Mishnaic, and Talmudic period in the Eastern countries, where the sundial divided the day into hours. It is also distinct from the modern period, where the invention of the mechanical clock at the end of the 14th century allowed for the division of the entire day into 24 equal parts. Water and sand clocks were found only in the homes of the lords and the wealthy. By the way, he's incorrect about the sand clocks also. If you take a look in about the history of sand clocks, we see that probably the oldest depiction of a sand glass, a technological innovation of the late 14th century, is found in the figure temperanti on the fresco Buon Governo in the Palazzo Pubblico in Siena. This fresco was painted in 1337, and this particular section is a part of an area which was put in 1355, and can no longer be determined whether the work is the figure of Temperantiano, one of the virtues assigned to good government, is carrying a sand glass. But in any event, the sand glass, that is, the sand clock as an instrument, was also not available during the time of Rabbeinu Tam, but is a couple of centuries later. There certainly were water clocks going way back into antiquity, but a little bit later on, I will also show from internal evidence that no such water clock existed anywhere near Rabbeinu Tam or in his communities. So Professor Katz is a little mild on this point. The general public counted in units of time dictated by the repeated daily tasks: rising in the morning, prayer, first meal in the middle of the morning, second meal in the afternoon or the evening, and so on. The Christian public divided its time according to the ringing of the bells, and the Jews followed these divisions. The daily routine to which Rabban and Rabbeinu Tam attest is a product of this situation. They were not and could not be precise regarding the prayer times, but determined the sequence of events. First, the Mincha and Maariv prayers, and then the evening meal. This order was considered hallowed by tradition and was the custom of the fathers mentioned in Rabbeinu Tam. However, this order was not compatible with a clear Talmudic halacha to which the community adhered. So in principle, the community believed that it was following the halacha as stated in the Gemara, in the Talmud, but in practice they did something else. It was therefore incumbent upon Rabbeinu Tam to demonstrate that the literary halachic sources did not contradict the custom of his community, and even to find support for this custom in the Talmudic tradition. In order to do this, he propounded an innovative interpretation unthought of by his predecessors. Namely, that the Mishnaic statement identifying the time when the priest entered to partake of the truma with nightfall is not an anonymous Mishnah, but the words of Rabbi Eliezer mentioned later as stating that the end of the time for reciting the Shema is the end of the first watch. The Mishnaic statement is thus only an individual opinion, according to Rabbeinu Tam. Moreover, there is a dispute between Rabbi Judah and the scholars concerning the time of the Mincha prayer. Rabbi Judah considers this to be in Tuplaga Mincha, that is one and a quarter hours before nightfall. According to Rabbi Judah, the day ends for the purpose of praying Mincha 1.25 hours before nightfall, and the time of the Maariv prayer begins immediately thereafter, and this is accepted opinion. Rabbi Hanano already made a similar argument, which Rabbeinu Tam considered a support for his reasoning. However, Rabbeinu Tam adds that this is the law regarding this recitation of the Shema as well, in contradiction to Rabbi Hanano's opinion. That is, Rabbi Yehuda's opinion regarding the Maariv prayer, according to which the nightfall begins 1.25 hours before the stars are visible, is applicable to reciting the Shema as well. By hypothesizing a disagreement that's not mentioned in the Talmud, typical of Rabbeinu Tam's method, and in accordance with his avowal that he considered the possibilities of resolving contradictions via the method of Pilpul to be unlimited, Rabbeinu Tam gave Ashkenazi custom a firm halakhic foundation. From this position of strength, he could counterattack and declare, he who changes the custom is called an ignoramus, and due to mindlessness, they make the Torah into two tikkurs and are stringent when they should be lenient and lenient when stringent she is called for. These trenchant words reveal some of the motivations driving the struggle between the reformers and the traditionalists. The reformers wish to make the religious custom fit the norm revealed to them in the halakhic sources which they studied. The traditionalists, on the other hand, gain priority to the uniformity of the religious custom of the community, claiming that even if one can find a halakhic flaw in the custom, those who deviate from it are being guilty of being stringent when they should be lenient. They indulge in halakhic pedantry and are lenient when the stringency is called for. They violate the consensus which unites the community. The audacity of Rabbeinu Tam's method laid it open to criticism, but the motivation behind it did not quickly disappear. Rabbi Isaac, Rabbeinu Tam's nephew, rejected his uncle's hypothesis, but upheld his ruling that the recitation of the Shema in the synagogue is certainly the essential prayer. He resolved the contradiction by saying simply that the Ashkenazic scholars upheld the opinions of those Panam who determined an early time for the reading of the Shema, from the day when the day terminates, from the people having the mercy. He too completely sanctioned the accepted custom in a similar, though not identical, fashion as Wabba. And now, well, it's not only today. Well, first of all, let's understand that always, whenever you have reformers in religion, they claim that they're going back to the original text. In the Christian religion, you had Luther who was saying, going back to the Bible and overthrowing the traditions of the Catholic Church.
The Reformation.
That's called the Reformation, yes. And that, but the issue here is something that we see all the time. That is that people who know a little, or maybe know a lot by indulging in scholarship, think that they know better than the community and therefore start to impose, in the name of going back to the sources, customs which deviate from the actual customs of the community. And in the main, Rabbeinu Tam was violently against it. And since he could reconcile any two texts if they contradicted one another by finding some resolution of the contradiction, it wasn't all that hard for him to reconcile the fact that the Mishnah simply doesn't coincide with the custom of the community, and therefore he resolved it by simply saying that the Mishnah was a minority opinion.
I thought maybe he's trying to show that the Minhag really is following Halacha.
Well, he does that by saying that what you see in the Mishnah is only a minority opinion. That's his resolution. Halacha is not like this Mishnah, even though no one says that that Mishnah was a minority opinion before Rabbeinu Tam. He took it for granted that he could make this change.
Could we say then, to avoid any parallel with today, that those who were establishing the Minhag were the elite educators? I mean, they were the Chachamim. It wasn't just every Tom, Dick, and Harry that was setting up a minhag. They wanted to start showing.
The situation, of course, is much more complicated than that. As Professor Katz points out, the custom as it evolved in Germany and France was that the Jews were following the rhythm of the ambient community, and as we saw from Professor Gornbar Rossum's book, the ambient community was moving not according to clock time, because there was no mechanical clock, and not according to sundial time, because you couldn't see a sundial most of the year, and furthermore, the sundials weren't all that widespread, but were following the bells that were being rung in the church, which established the seven daily prayers in the church, and in particular, the evening meal. The major meal was we would call it brunch, but a major meal was in the late morning, and then there was a lighter meal for supper. Both, the supper was had well before sunset because there was no cheap form of artificial illumination, and therefore the community would daven mincha and maariv because they regulated their life according to the standard community. I mean, that's like we may regulate our life because the CBS News comes on at 6:30 or whatever. So,
but those who were practicing the Minhag were altered. I don't say tradition. They were all religious Jews.
They were all religious Jews, and they were all
breakaways.
There were no breakaways. Yeah. To the contrary, the breakaways in this case were the Fromachs,
the
scholars, the people who said that they know better than the community.
What we would call traditionalists today.
Wow.
Well, let's take a look on page 105 because Professor Katz discusses this. There was a later question about that. But by the time you get to the 15th or the 16th century, the issue became whether that's an hour and a quarter before sunset or an hour and a quarter before when the stars come out. But at the time of Rabbeinu Tam, everyone seemed to agree that it was an hour and a quarter before it was Seita Kochavim. But the problem is that nobody knew what an hour and a quarter was. There was no way of measuring time.
Walking 3 miles.
Well, people, they didn't pay a hired walker to do this walk every day to find out whether it was time to dump. Let's go to page...
Not all that, but you have to do that.
Right.
In the context of this information, several years ago we went to a Reformed wedding that was called for 6 p.m. on a Saturday during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you can't have a cocoa on the Shabbat. Service,
I see. Right. All right. Let's go to page 105 in Katz. All of this is really very important.
And also one more thing. For example, in Hungary during the time, a long time, when it was not comfortable to Jews walking after dark, so went to the shul and Davan Mariv much earlier,
mm-hmm.
and then went home and eat supper.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did not keep it in regular time.
Right.
So that happened.
Yes, we will see that there were variations in all of this as we move from the 12th century forward. But let's take a look at what Professor Katz has to say on page 105. From a historical perspective, and in particular in terms of halakhic history, this issue represents a clash between the traditional practice of the Ashkenazi communities and the literary tradition that reached them. As long as a knowledge of the law was not widespread, everyone relied primarily on local tradition, and no doubts were raised as to its validity. When the study of the sources intensified, and scholars achieved the authority to decide on the basis of study and analysis, contradictions between the result of the study and local tradition were occasionally revealed. This process began even prior to Rashi's time and continued throughout his period with him playing an active part, although generally with no open confrontation between the two sources of authority and without the sense that this confrontation might endanger the status of accepted custom. During the Tosafot period, the process accelerated and a systematic examination of the validity of local custom was undertaken. Just as the Tosafos took the trouble to make a comparison between the literary sources, that is, between two different literary sources, and to find a resolution of, or compromise for, contradictions, so did they act regarding the custom and the halakhic sources. In resolving the conflict between the custom and literary authority, they used the same dialectic method employed in resolving contradictions between one source and another, the tendency being, of course, to preserve the custom and to interpret the source in a way that should not cast any doubt on the validity of the accepted practice. Just as Rabbeinu Tam used his keen mind to explain apparent contradictions between the sources, so did he eliminate many doubts concerning customs which seemed to lack any basis in the halakhic sources. His opponents claimed that he was not consistent in his methods, at times favoring the literary source and deviating from the accepted norm, while he, for his part, attempted to explain his position and the guiding principles of his ruling. He certainly upheld the general principle that a custom should not be discarded because of an apparent contradiction found in a literary source. However, granting validity of the custom in opposition to the halakhic source was not acceptable to all. Rabbi Shmushulam and Rabbi Elijah of Paris understood the comparison of custom with halakhic sources to be an open issue whose conclusions were undecided. Either the source could be interpreted in accordance with the custom, or the custom could be changed to fit the halachic source. If the halachic give and take led to the conclusion that the custom was not correct, they were willing to change it in order to suit the primary sources, first and foremost the Babylonian Talmud, whose authority no one questioned. This is an attempt at quasi-reform, i.e. a return to the authentic religious sources by abolishing the absolute value of accepted modes of conduct. The propounders of this view were of unquestionable religious standing in their own time, and Rabbi Elijah of Paris was even a pious and modest man, in the words of Rabbeinu Tam's opponent. We must therefore assume that they are motivated by religious conscience, for they believe that it's not custom which should guide men to attempt to fulfill God's commandment, but the law stored in the ancient literary tradition. Although opponents of the school of thought cast no aspersion on the purity of this people and their motives, they were aware of the danger inherent in their actions. In the same breath which he praises Rabbi Elijah of Paris, Rabbeinu Tam calls his way close to heresy. This sharp condemnation can only be understood in light of Rabbeinu Tam's fear that an examination of the validity of the customs was likely to challenge the validity of all patterns of religious life. Rabbeinu Tam's rejection of any times in the change of the Maariv prayer, either during the week or on the Sabbath, may be considered as part of a consistent and sharply delineated stance.
I understand that part of the but what Rabbeinu Tam tried to, he was concerned with what?
In Rabbeinu Tam, the Baalei HaTosfot, as you know from studying the Tosfot, try to resolve a contradiction between two passages in the Gemara. And they do that in one means or another. But they also had to attempt to resolve a contradiction between what it says in the Gemara, or in the Mishnah, and what their local practice was. And here, someone like Rabbeinu Tam and the Ravan, in the main, tried to assert the authority of the custom. So for example, in this particular case, since the custom was that everybody would daven Mincha and Maariv, including Shema and the Brachos, while it was still daylight, perhaps even before the sun set, and then have their evening meal. And even though this clearly went against the first Mishnah and the Masechet Brachot, Rabbeinu Tam resolved the matter by simply saying that the first Mishnah is only a minority opinion. Nobody before him said that, but he was willing to say that it was a minority opinion because it was, according to his view, it was necessary to uphold the custom and not the written text. So therefore he was willing to reinterpret the written text to make it consistent. Furthermore,
so he's in a sense saying halacha is wrong, but not wrong.
No, he's not saying about halacha is wrong. Many times in dealing with a halachic question, you have one Gemara saying one thing and another Gemara saying something else, and you have to resolve it by one way or another.
Well, there's a role.
That's not a question of rov. Sometimes, if you have a contradiction between two texts, as we will see in a couple of weeks, in a closely related manner, Rabbeinu Tam will resolve this by giving an answer to a question. Whenever there's a kashi, you can find some kind of an answer. But Rabbeinu Tam took two very firm positions. One is that the local custom, the traditional custom of the community, has at least as much validity as the written text. That's number one. And therefore, he was willing to give a rather far-fetched interpretation to a written text by saying that it was a minority opinion rather than a majority opinion in order to uphold the custom. And the second item on which he is very firm is that he doesn't tolerate someone being more frum than the rest. He doesn't tolerate the idea that a scholar should somehow behave differently than the entire community. The idea that the community as a whole is saying Kriya Shema early, but I, who have studied Masechet Brachot and know better, will repeat the Kriya Shema later, as Rashi, for example, suggested, is unacceptable to Rabbeinu Tam. So these are two important principles of Rabbeinu Tam. He was, of course, never consistent in this, because he may have had acted differently in different cases, but basically the position that he took was that the tradition of the community is at least as hallowed as some text that you can find. So you try to resolve the text. And secondly, a person should not think that he's better than anybody else. And that, of course, was the objection that the Meiri made to all of these students who were the Meiri was more tolerant of Rabbeinu Tam. He said to those students, if you want to say Kriya Shema over again, fine, but don't stop blabbering and complaining that the community as a whole is not being as good as you are. If you want to be special, do it for yourself, but don't make the pretense.
Can the same argument be cast in terms of younger change?
No. Well, that's a different issue. But so now, I want to derive three things from this. First of all, that in fact we know that the Jewish practice was because their rhythm of the day was the same as everybody's rhythm of the day. And therefore, even though the Ravana and Rabbeinu Tam may have felt that this was something instituted by the Rishonim, in fact, it just simply reflected the daily routine. Secondly, if there was such a common practice, Rabbeinu Tam was willing to sustain it as against something in the Gemara. And thirdly, that Rabbeinu Tam did not tolerate a flamach, someone who is going to be more religious than anybody else. The Meiri was willing to tolerate these people as long as they kept their mouths shut. But if they started to also complain that the shul is not behaving properly, then okay.
And does that mean that the community costume can be changed?
According to Rabbeinu Tam, one shouldn't.
But let's say in Brooklyn, they daven before sunset in Helmara, but Brighton didn't. And Brighton community says that it's better at the Brooklyn, and suddenly they change it. Is that acceptable?
We will move up into the 20th century gradually. Let's first see what was happening in the time of Rabbeinu Tam. There was a fourth item which is very important, that is a corollary of all of this. When did Rabbeinu Tam light candles on Friday night? When did his wife light candles?
After that.
No. He says that you daven Maariv and he certainly lit the candles before they daven Maariv. And they daven Maariv while the sun was still...
And on Shabbos early.
So whatever we see as a corollary of all of this, and this is going to be very important for us, is that certainly Rabbeinu Tam lit candles before sunset, like we all do today, lit candles before sunset on Friday night. All of this argument was whether you have to say Shema over again, but they certainly got the Maariv before it got dark. They ate their supper before it got dark.
They may have Dala before it got dark.
But they did that as well on Saturday night.
On Saturday night, they may not have lit any candles until it got dark.
That was my question.
But it's certainly clear that Rabbeinu Tam did not follow what it says in the Shulchan Aruch that the time of being Mosif Michol Al HaKodesh starts after sunset. Remember, we raised this problem that the Shulchan Aruch gives us 58 and a half minutes after sunset as the voluntary time, and that you're able, and you should light candles sometime after sunset before 58 and a half minutes after sunset. What we see clearly from this is that certainly Rabbeinu Tam did not practice any differently than we practice today, namely that we lit candles before the sun set on a Friday night. That's clear. Secondly, Rabbeinu Tam could not possibly have waited 72 minutes after sunset before he made Havdalah, for the very simple reason that he didn't have a clock. He had no way of measuring time.
He looked up for three stars,
or if it was a cloudy day, he waited until it got very dark. Yeah. But there was no possibility for him to wait 72 minutes. No possibility.
There are also things that you can't tell when sunset.
For example? Well, if it's still light, you'll light candles early. We had lots of examples of people who, it was a very cloudy day, lit candles, and then it turned out that the sun was still high in the sky, and therefore it was an error. There are cases like that, but I want to simply say, on a regular basis, Rabbeinu Tam and his entire community could not possibly have followed what we saw in the Shulchan Aruch last week. On Friday night, he certainly lit candles before the sun set, and on Saturday night, he could not possibly have waited 72 minutes because he had absolutely no way of measuring the time. There was no clock, there was no sand clock, and as I will show later, there was no water clock. So therefore, the concept that is cited today in the name of Rabbeinu Tam, namely that you can light candles after the sun sets, and on Motzai Shabbos you have to wait at least 72 minutes, certainly could not have been Rabbeinu Tam's practice. Those are the four conclusions that we want to draw. One was that there was a different approach between someone like Rav Haigel, who was head of an elite institution and following the Gemara, and he could therefore tell people that you should be more formed with your community, and Rabbeinu Tam would have none of this. Secondly, Rabbeinu Tam and all of the Chachmei Ashkenaz defended the local custom as opposed to the Gemara and found some way or another to resolve that conflict. Third, that the nature of the custom that was in Ashkenaz was because the Jewish daily routine did not differ from the ambient daily routine. Everybody, as we saw last week, had shifted the day earlier. The ninth hour, the nones, became noon. 3 o'clock in the afternoon was shifted back to when the sun is directly overhead. The entire Roman day had shifted backward, and with it, the Jewish day. And finally, that Rabbeinu Tam could not possibly have followed what is cited as Rabbeinu Tam's Shita, which is that you light candles sometime after sunset, and you make Havdalah 72 minutes after the sunset, because on Friday night he certainly did the candles well in the daytime, because he got married and had supper before the sunset, and on Saturday night he had no way of measuring that. So there's something mysterious going on here, but whatever it is, we've elucidated first a dichotomy between various approaches between custom and the written text, where the Ashkenazi communities enshrined the custom, and secondly, deviation to be more frum than the rest was not allowed, and third, that Rabbeinu Tam did not practice what is known in the yeshivas today as Rabbeinu Tam Shita.
So, if you point out that they didn't have accurate measuring devices, so what semantics do you describe the statements in the Gemara about the time it takes to walk? What do you do with that?
We'll discuss that. But certainly, remember, there was a may of measuring time during the period of the Gemara. They had a sundial. And they also had water clocks. There was no such way of measuring time in Northern Europe in the 10th, 11th, or 12th century. In a Roman city, the part of the function of the city was divide the day up into various clock times, part of the municipal, with the decline of the cities, this disappeared. And as we saw last week, the daily rhythm of the entire community was just based on what you do first, and what you do second, and what you do third, and what you do afterwards. But there was no division of the day into hours or into anything else.
What's the term of the
Delta? Did they finish the matins? In other words, there was no fixed time. I mean, we read this in clearly from the history of the hour. There was the canonical, so-called canonical hours were a sequence of when you do what. And if it took you a little bit longer to say one prayer and you rang the bells after you finished. What was important was the sequence, but not the exact time.
But these prayers don't take, they don't fully occupy all the time.
No, there's a whole series of what the monks have to do. Right, but this was extremely flexible. But the main thing was that you had a main meal in the late morning, you had another supper well before the sunset, you went to sleep more or less with sunset. Now, of course, there was a change in European practice from the Middle Ages until the 16th or 17th century, due to a whole lot of various things happening. But at the moment, we're stuck in the 11th or 12th century, and there was no clock, and the daily routine was just simply followed in sequence, and maybe the bells of the church helped a little bit, but those bells were only rung as a sequence of words. Now, it will turn out that someone invented a gadget which allowed you to make a rotating wheel give something a back and forth motion. So in other words, there was something to allow, by pulling a pulley or driving a weight, convert the rotational movement into a back and forth motion so that you could actually ring the bell by a mechanical device. And then someone, somewhere in the middle of the end of the 13th or beginning of the 14th century turned this idea around and realized that you could use the back and forth motion to control the rotation of the wheel, and which of course led to the mechanical clock. So that's the next stage in history, and we may or may not get to it next week, but we'll try to get to work it out. But up until at this period of time, there was no mechanical clock, no sand clock, no water clock except in very isolated sources, and we'll stop here and continue.
When the daylight was divided into 12 equal parts, how did they count?
Who's they?
Well, Romans, I don't know.
The Romans had sundials.
But you said the daylight hours were divided into 12 and the nighttime hours were divided.
Well, for the nighttime they had to have something like a water clock.
My question is, then how did they count the hours? The hours had to be counted from sunrise to sunset?
Or a little bit before sunrise.
Okay,
but from sunrise.
So 12 o'clock would be sunset.
Yeah, sure.
So how did it get moved 6 hours up? Because now we have 12 o'clock, means midday.
Okay, that's a very good question. We today, we'll go into this in some detail. We today have our clock start at midnight.
Yeah.
Now this was astronomers' time. Astronomers like to do that. But in fact, after the invention of the mechanical clock, there were two competing methods of counting the hours of the day. The German clock, which eventually won out, as the day start at midnight. But the Italian clock had the 24th hour end with Seisakochot. So when you see someone like the Bach talking about the 22nd hour, he's talking about 2 hours before Seisakochot. So there were two competing clocks.
That's the Jewish time.
And the Italians adopted the Jewish time. Let's put it this way. The Italians adopted the Jewish time, and up until the beginning of the... Goethe already mentions, even as late as Goethe, he mentions the fact that when you travel in Italy, the concept of time is different from that which it was in Germany. But all of these are much later developments, because we still haven't gotten to the time in which the mechanical clock was invented or widely distributed. But at the time that it was distributed, there were two competing systems. There were several others. There was a strange clock in Basel, which is different from anybody else's. But the two major competing times were the Italian clock, which fixed the end of the 24th hour at approximately, let's say in Italy, a half an hour after sunset, and the German clock, which fixed the end of the 24th hour in the middle of the night. Now, of course, something like the Italian clock had to be adjusted every day, because although you had 24 equal hours, the end of the 24th hour shifted from day to day, so they adjusted it once a week, or every day, or twice a month. But this was no big deal, because the clocks were so inaccurate that every clock had to be adjusted. In other words, if a clock gained or lost 15 minutes a day, that was no big deal, because the precision of the clocks came much later. And of course, there were still other shifts, which was the introduction of the time zones, and so on.